The Third Eye by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend. Chapter 11, Trappa. My youthful determination was devoted to passing the examination at the first attempt. As the date of my 12th birthday approached, I gradually slackened off studies, for the examination started on the day after my birthday. The past years had been filled with intensive studies. Astrology, herbal medicine, anatomy, religious ethics, and even on the correct compounding of incense. Tibetan and Chinese languages, with special reference to good calligraphy and mathematics. There had been little time for games. The only game we had time for was judo, because we had a stiff examination on this subject. About 3 months before, the Lama, Mingyar Dondup, had said, "Not so much revision, Lob Sang. It merely clutters up the memory. Be quite calm as you are now, and the knowledge will be there." So the day arrived. At 6 in the morning, I and 15 other candidates presented ourselves at the examination hall. We had a short service to put us in the right frame of mind, and then to make sure that none of us had yielded to unpriestly temptation, we had to strip and be searched, after which we were given clean robes. The chief examiner led the way from the little temple of the examination hall to the closed cubicles. These were stone boxes, about 6 feet by 10 feet in size, and about 8 feet high. Outside the boxes, the police monks patrolled all the time. Each of us was led to a cubicle and told to enter. The door was shut, locked, and a seal applied. When all of us had been sealed into our own little box, monks brought writing material and the first set of questions to a small trap in the wall. We were also brought buttered tea and sampa. The monk who brought that told us that we could have sampa 3 times a day and tea as often as we wanted. Then we were left to deal with the first paper. One subject a day for 6 days, and we had to work from the first light in the morning until it was too dark at night to see. Our cubicles had no roof, so we got whatever light came into the main examination hall. We stayed in our own separate boxes all the time. For no reason whatever were we permitted to leave. As the evening light began to fade, a monk appeared at the trap and demanded our papers. We then lay down to sleep until the following morning. From my own experience, I can say that an examination paper on one subject, which takes 14 hours to answer, certainly does test one's knowledge and nerves. On the night of the 6th day, the written examinations were at an end. We were kept in our cubicles that night because in the morning we had to clean them out and leave them as we found them. The rest of the day was ours to spend as we desired. 3 days after, when our written work had been checked and our weaknesses noted, we were called before the examiners one at a time. They asked us questions based on our weak points only, and their interrogation occupied the whole of the day. The next morning, the 16 of us had to go to the room where we were taught judo. This time, we were going to be examined on our knowledge of strangleholds, locks, breakfalls, throws, and self-control. Each of us had to engage with three other candidates. The failures were soon weeded out. Gradually, the others were eliminated, and at last, due solely to my early training at the hands of Tzu, I was the only one left. I, at least, had passed top in judo, but only because of my early training, which at the time I had thought was brutal and unfair. We were given the next day to recover from the hard days of examination, and on the day following we were informed of the results. I and four others had passed. We would now become trappas, or medical priests. The Lama, Mingyar Dondup, whom I had not seen during the whole time of the examinations, sent for me to go to his room. As I entered, he beamed upon me. "You have done well, Lobsang. You are at the top of the list. The Lord Abbot has sent a special report to the Inmost One. He wanted to suggest that you may be made a Lama right away, but I have opposed it." He saw my rather pained look and explained, "It is much better to study and pass on your own merits. To be given the status is to miss much training, training which you will find vital in later life. However, you can move into the room next to mine because you will pass the examination when the time comes." That seemed fair enough to me. I was quite willing to do whatever my guide thought best. It gave me a thrill to realize that my success was his success, that he would get the credit for training me to pass as the highest in all subjects. Later in the week, a gasping messenger, tongue protruding and almost at the point of death, apparently, arrived with a message from the Inmost One. Messengers always use their histrionic talents to impress upon one the speed of which they had traveled and the hardships they had endured to deliver the message entrusted to them. As if Patella was only a mile or so away, I thought his act was rather overdone. The Inmost One congratulated me on my pass and said that I was to be regarded as a Lama from that date. I was to wear Lama robes and have all the rights and privileges of that status. He agreed with my guide that I should take the examinations when I was 16 years of age, as in this way you will be induced to study those things which you would otherwise avoid, and so your knowledge will be increased by such studying. Now that I was a Lama, I should have more freedom to study without being held back by a class. It also meant that anyone with specialized knowledge was free to teach me, so I could learn as quickly as I wished. One of the earliest things I had to learn was the art of relaxation, without which no real study of metaphysics can be undertaken. One day, the Lama Mingyar Dondup came into the room where I was studying some books. He looked at me and said, "Lobsang, you are looking quite tense. You will not progress at peaceful contemplation unless you relax. I will show you how to do it." He told me to lie down as a start, for although one can relax sitting or even standing up, it is better to learn first by being supine. Imagine you have fallen off a cliff, he said. Imagine that you are on the ground below, a crumpled figure with all the muscles slack, with limbs bent as they have fallen, and with your mouth slightly open, for only then are the cheek muscles at ease. I fidgeted around until I had put myself in the position he wanted. Now imagine that your arms and legs are full of little people who made you work by pulling on muscles. Tell those little people to leave your feet so that there is no feeling, no movement, no tension there. Let your mind explore your feet to be certain that no muscles are being used. I lay there trying to imagine little people. Think of old Tzu wiggling my toes from the inside. Oh, I'll be glad to get rid of him. Then do the same with your legs. Your muscles were hard at work this morning when you were jumping. Now give them a rest. Feel around with your mind. Make them leave the muscles untended so that they are slack and flaccid. Suddenly he stopped and pointed. Look, you have forgotten someone in your thigh. A little man is keeping a tight muscle in your upper leg. Get him out, love sang. Get him out. Finally, my legs were relaxed to his satisfaction. Now do the same with your arms, starting with your fingers. Make them leave up past the wrists. March them to the elbows, to the shoulders. Imagine that you are calling away all those little people so that there is no longer any strain or tension or feeling. After I had got so far, he said, now we come to the body itself. Pretend that your body is a lamassery. Think of all the monks inside pulling on muscles to make you work. Tell them to leave. See that they leave the lower part of the body first, after slackening off all the muscles. Make them drop what they are doing and leave. Make them loosen your muscles, all your muscles, so that your body is held together merely by the outer covering, so that everything sags and droops and finds its own level. Then your body is relaxed. Apparently he was satisfied with my stage of progress, for he continued, the head is perhaps the most important part for relaxation. Let us see what we can do with it. Look at your mouth. You have a tight muscle at each corner. Ease it off, Lobsang. Ease it off each side. You are not going to speak or eat, so no tension, please. Your eyes are screwed up. There is no light to trouble them, so just lightly close the eyes, just lightly, without any tension. He turned away and looked out the open window. Our finest exponent of relaxation is outside, sunning herself. You could take a lesson from the way in which a cat relaxes. There is none who can do it better. It takes quite a long time to write this, and it seems difficult when it is read, but with just a little practice, it is a simple matter to relax within a second. This system of relaxation is one which never fails. Those who are tense with the cares of civilization would do well to practice on these lines and the mental system which follows. For this latter, I was advised to proceed somewhat differently. The Lama, Mingyar Dondup, said, "There is little gain in being at ease physically if you are tense mentally. As you lie here physically relaxed, let your mind, for a moment, dwell on your thoughts. Idly follow those thoughts and see what they are. See how trivial they are. Then stop them. Permit no more thoughts to flow. Imagine a black square of nothingness, with the thoughts trying to jump from one side to the other. At first, some will jump across. Go after them, bring them back, and make them jump back across that black space. Really imagine it. Visualize it strongly, and in a very short time, you will see blackness without effort, and so enjoy perfect mental and physical relaxation." Here again, it is far more difficult to explain than do. It really is a very simple affair with slight practice. And one must have relaxation. Many people have never shut off their mind and thoughts, and they are like the people who try to keep going physically day and night. A person who tried to walk without rest for a few days and nights would soon collapse, yet the brain and mind are given no rest. With us, everything was done to train the mind. We were taught judo to a high standard as an exercise in self-control. The Lama who taught us judo could repel and defeat 10 attackers at once. He loved judo and went out of his way to make the subject as interesting as possible. Strangle holds may seem savage and cruel to Western minds, but such an impression would be utterly wrong. As I have already shown, by giving a certain little touch to the neck, we could make a person unconscious in a fraction of a second before he knew he was losing consciousness. The little pressure paralyzed the brain harmlessly. In Tibet, where there are no anesthetics, we often use that pressure when extracting a difficult tooth or in setting bones. The patient knew nothing, suffered nothing. It is also used in initiations when the ego is released from the body to do astral traveling. With this judo training, we were almost immune to falls. Part of judo is to know how to land gently. Break falls, it is termed, and it was a common exercise for us boys to jump off a 10 or 15 foot wall just for fun. Every other day, before starting our judo practice, we had to recite the steps of the middle way, the keystones of Buddhism. Right views, which are views and opinions free from delusions and self-seeking. Right aspirations, by which one shall have high and worthy intentions and opinions. Right speech, in which one is kind, considerate, and truthful. Right conduct. This makes one peaceful, honest, and selfless. Right livelihood. To obey this, one must avoid hurting men or animals, and must give the latter their rights as beings. Right effort. One must have self-control and undergo constant self-training. Right mindfulness. In having the right thoughts and in trying to do that which is known to be right, and right rapture. This is the pleasure derived from meditating on the realities of life and of the Overself. If any one of us offended against the steps, we had to lie face down across the main entrance to the temple, so that all who entered had to step over the body. Here we would stay from the first dawn until dark, with no movement and no food or drink. It was considered to be a disgrace. Now I was a Lama, one of the elite, one of the superior ones. It sounded just fine, but there were catches. Before, I had to obey the frightening number of 32 rules of priestly conduct. As a Lama, to my horror and dismay, I found that the total was 253. And at Chakpori, the wise Lama did not break any of those rules. It seemed to me that the world was so full of things to learn, I thought my head would burst. But it was pleasant to sit up on the roof and watch the Dalai Lama arrive at the Norbu Linga, or Jewel Park, just down below. I had to keep hidden when I watched the Precious One, for no one must look down on him. Down below, too, but on the other side of our Iron Mountain, I could look on two beautiful parks, the Kati Linga, and just across the stream, called the Kaling Chu, the Dodpal Linga. Linga means park, or at least it is the nearest spelling according to the Western style of writing. More to the north, I could gaze upon the Western Gate, the Pargo Kaling. This great Chortan straddled across the road leading from Drepung near the village of Sho and on to the heart of the city. Nearer, almost at the foot of the Chakpori, was a Chortan commemorating one of our historical heroes, King Kesar, who lived in the warlike days before Buddhism and peace came to Tibet. Work? We had plenty of that, but we had our compensations, our pleasures as well. It was compensation in full and brimming over to associate with men like the Lama Mingyur Dondup, men whose sole thought was peace and help for others. It was payment, too, to be able to look over this beautiful valley, so green and peopled with well-loved trees, to see the blue waters meandering through the land between the mountain ranges, to see the gleaming Chortans, the picturesque lamaseries and hermitages perched on the inaccessible crags, to look with reverence on the golden domes of the Patala so near to us, and the shining roofs of the Jokhang a little farther to the east. The comradeship of the others, the rough good fellowship of the lesser monks, and the familiar scent of incense as it wafted around the temples, these things made up our life, and it was a life worth living. Hardship? Yes, there was plenty, but it was worth it. In any community, there are those of little understanding, of little faith, but here, at Chakpori, they were indeed in the minority. End of chapter 11.